This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time for November 5th. My guest is Simon Winchester, historian and inveterate traveler, speaking with us today about the Atlantic Ocean. The subtitle of your new book, Simon, promises great sea battles, heroic discoveries, titanic storms, and a vast ocean of a million stories. With which one among the million would you like to begin?
Well, I might say to begin with that the subtitle was essentially forced on me by Barnes & Noble, who said, you cannot call this what you want to call it, which is Atlantic, a biography of the ocean. We've got to tell the reader what's in it. Of all the stories, I suppose the one that fascinates me most is in a way the most complex, and that's that the state of Israel was essentially born in the Atlantic Ocean. In 1916, the Royal Navy was losing the Battle of the Atlantic. By that I mean that the German submarines that were torpedoing the eastbound ships bringing grain and goodies for the British Isles were being sunk by submarines that in those days would come to the surface to fire their torpedoes. And what should happen is that the Royal Navy, when they saw a submarine on the surface, would fire at it and sink it. But unfortunately, the Royal Navy was running short of cordite for the guns, and they were running short because they were short of a particular chemical, the chemical acetone. So that's the sort of background to the story. And the story is that every Tuesday in Manchester in 1916, the then editor of the Manchester Guardian, C.P. Scott, would have lunch with someone who he found interesting. And on this particular summer Tuesday, he had lunch with a white Russian emigre who was the professor of biology at the University of Manchester called Chaim Weizmann. And Weizmann, among other things, said to Scott over lunch, I have developed a new way of producing acetone. C.P. Scott had never heard of acetone, but nonetheless he kept it in the back of his mind. And the following week he was down in London having lunch with David Lloyd George, who at the time was the Minister of Munitions in the war government. And Lloyd George said, you know, we're having a terrible time. The Royal Navy chaps are losing the Battle of the Atlantic because we've run out of some pesky chemical called acetone. A light went off in C.P. Scott's head and he said, well, I've met this extraordinary chap last week who says he can make it. Better have him down to London. So Weizmann is put on a train, brought down to London, interviewed, turned out not to be a nutcase. And what do you need? I need something like a brewery or a distillery. Fine, they said, we've got a disused gin factory called Nicholson's Gin Company in London. You can have that. What else do you need? Well, a supply of maize or something. How about chestnuts? And they said, yes, chestnuts. So that autumn, children all over Britain were told to pick chestnuts off the trees, which they normally did at that time of year to play a game called Conkers, but not to play the game, put them in sacks, which were sent down to London, poured into the hoppers in the gin factory, and using Chaim Weizmann's magic, acetone started to pour out of the taps, sent down to the Royal Navy ammunition factory, turned into cordite, the guns started firing again, the submarines started sinking, the whole tide of the Battle of the Atlantic changed. So come the summer of 1917, when it was clear that that had happened, the British government said, we've got to give an honour to this man Weizmann. We better, as he's a foreigner, ask you, Arthur Balfour, Foreign Secretary, to interview him and say that His Majesty's government would like to give him a knighthood. So they had Weizmann down to London, and he said to Arthur Balfour, it's very nice of you to offer me a knighthood, but I don't want one. I'm secretary of the English Zionist League, and I would much prefer that instead of an honour to me, you would write a letter saying that His Majesty's government would look with favour upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. And indeed, Arthur Balfour said, I think I can do that. And so the Balfour Declaration, 17th of November 1917, came out the basis of the formation of the State of Israel.
Tell us what you meant by a biography of the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, the Atlantic was born about 200 million years ago. Geological event when this one supercontinent that existed on the planet called Pangaea split into two, and the surrounding single sea, which was called Panthalassa, poured into the crack between the two, and that was the beginnings of the ocean. So it had a birth. Geological futurists also can predict with some degree of accuracy when it is going to cease to be, and that's in about 170 million years time.
So we're halfway through the life
exactly.
of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah. So the total life will be about 400 million years, and then humankind comes along, as you say, just about halfway through, for about 200,000 years. And that's what the book really concentrates on. The prologue is all the formation, the epilogue is the death of the ocean, and then the 200,000 years of us, organized it according to the seven ages of man from Shakespeare's As You Like It. So infancy, childhood, lover, school, all the rest of it. It's really concentrating on humankind's relationship with the ocean.
Tell us the infant attitude of humankind.
Well, the first time we know that humankind encountered the ocean was about 160,000 years ago. There's a cave, a place called Pinnacle Point. The cave itself is called PP13B, just below a golf course in South Africa. And that appears to be the place at which humans, early humans, having found their origins in Ethiopia, moving slowly down the Rift Valley, down the savannas, suddenly they come to a cliff. Beyond the cliff is something they've never seen before, which is this endless expanse of water. They climb down the cliff, they find shelter in a cave, this PP13B cave, and then they settle there for a while and they start to do something which they've then been doing for since then, which is to eat seafood, and specifically to eat oysters, because there were thousands of oyster shells. And that famous G.K. Chesterton quote about it was a brave man who ate the first oyster. Well, it clearly was the first man who ate the first oyster, because that's what they did. So that's when mankind had his first encounter with the sea, and his first commercial encounter that we know of was the Phoenicians. And that was about 700 years B.C., or before the Christian era, when they went out from the Mediterranean in their little boats, through the Pillars of Hercules, into this sea that at that time had never really been seen by anyone. It had just been regarded as a fearful thing of monsters and storms and myths and legends, something that the edge of the world was there. But these Phoenicians decided they would sail out there, and they turned left and went down the coast of what is now Morocco, and they happened upon a pair of islands, which are to this day called the Îles Purpurées, the Purple Isles, because there they discovered huge quantities of a shell, murex shells, from which they could extract the purple dye that the Mediterranean aristocracy, most notably the Romans, used to dye the clothes of their leadership. And so the Phoenicians came back, having established a little trading port there, the first ever trading port in the Atlantic or on the Atlantic, and for hundreds of years used it as a base for further exploration and for trade.
But the Mediterranean is the center of the world in antiquity, the Greek and Roman world. You say in your book that the Atlantic is the focus, the fulcrum, the axis, the center of what we know today as the Western civilization. And when does that turn come? When does the door open from the Mediterranean into the Atlantic?
It essentially opens towards the close of the 15th century, when you have the Turks essentially closing the eastbound overland trade routes to traders from the Mediterranean, who are then forced, if they want to go to the east, to turn westwards to do it. And that, of course, was the driving force that impelled, first of all, Columbus to go across looking for the spices of the east, but finding that inconveniently the new world got in his way. And this led, of course, to the discovery that there was another world between the East and Europe, and that therefore was an ocean, which at that point had never been truly recognized. We didn't know that the Atlantic Ocean was a discrete and separate sea. 15th century, essentially, is when it all started.
What is the attitude toward it during the 16th century, during the age of exploration? Is it still looked upon with dread?
Increasingly, it was not looked upon with dread, no. The moment we got the measure of it. I mean, it was the Vikings who, after all, were very first across it in the very northern part of the ocean. Leif Erikson, who was the first to settle in North America in 1001 AD, that only lasted for a very short time. They found the sea terrifying, and the myths of all these strange ships and monsters and whirlpools, that remained part of the public consciousness well until the 16th century. And then once the galleon trade began, and once it became evident that the sea was manageable, that it was something that we could sail across and take advantage of the currents and the winds, and we could use its winds and currents intelligently, then once we had the measure of it, it ceased to be something we fear. But part of the argument in the book is that, of course, we don't fear it, we treat it with disdain, and that is not necessarily a good thing.
Before we get to the disdain, first tell me the size of it, and then tell me the poetical, the age of the lover, the romance of the ocean, point of view of painters and poets.
This follows very much the public attitude to the sea as it changes from we regard it with fear until we regard it as a thing of great beauty and awe and majesty and romance. And we see this in all the aspects of the artistic world. We see it in poetry, the way the early 5th, 6th, 7th century poets, the Anglo-Saxons, the Irish, who first ventured into it and wrote about it. Initially, they regarded it as a terrifying thing, and they were so glad to get back to land. But you see this change. You see poems written in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, longing to go to sea, people writing with intense romanticism about the sea as an entity. Attitude has changed in poetry, but also in literature, in painting too. First of all, it was monsters. The paintings were allegorical and they were filled with curious and frightening beasts. Then, in the 17th century, we painted ships and we gave relatively little regard to the sea as the sea. Then later, 19th century, we get people like J.M.W. Turner and Winslow Homer, leading into the 20th century, where we suddenly start painting the sea as the sea and regard it as majestic and romantic and wonderful. So in all fields of art, we watch this evolution from terror to acceptance to awe.
And then to commerce. We tame the wildness of the sea and set up innumerable trade routes and lay cables and catch fish.
Yes, and then, of course, we go a bit too far. I mean, to me, these are all intensely romantic stories at their beginnings, the laying of the cables. I mean, this was all financed initially by a man who had he was a papermaker from Western Massachusetts, where I live, and he financed the first great transatlantic cable and the technical difficulties of actually laying it, where the two ships had each carried half. They met in the middle of the ocean, they stitched the two halves of the cable together, and they moved away from each other, one ending up in Newfoundland and one in Ireland, and then the cable worked, although initially it only worked for a couple of weeks and then broke down, and it was another 5 years before they built another one. And then there was Marconi patiently waiting on a clifftop in Newfoundland for being able to hear his colleagues far away in Cornwall tapping out the letter S, did it in Morse code, and eventually hearing it and then realizing that radio signals could cross the Atlantic. And then we have the first flyers, Alcock and Brown, who in 1919, they disassembled an aircraft, they took it to Newfoundland, they built their own airstrip, they set off in this little Vickers Vimy bomber with two pet kittens on board, Twinkletoes and Lucky Jim, and after 16 and a half hours, they crash-landed into a bog in Galway. All of these stories of commercial pioneering I find absolutely fascinating. But unfortunately, the corollary to it all is what exists today. We fished, but now we overfish. We come to a place like the Flemish Cap or the Grand Banks of Newfoundland that used to be teeming with cod. And because of human greed, there is no cod left at all. We fly aircraft over it and we dump hundreds of tons of carbon deposits over the sea. Our ships leave gigantic trails of pollution behind them. And the British government, particularly notoriously the British government, dumping hundreds of tons of radioactive material into the ocean in the belief that it's so big it can absorb anything. Well, it can't. The ocean turns out to be surprisingly fragile, and all this pollution and overfishing is having a serious effect on it.
I've followed your writings for years, Simon, and I know that you've seen the Atlantic from many vantage points, from St. Helena, Cape Town, Cape Cod, Ushant, the Faroe Islands, Greenland. What is to you the most memorable of your sightings of the Atlantic?
That's really difficult to say in a way, but I think if I had to choose one place that I cherish most of all, it's the little and perfectly preserved capital, I wouldn't say capital city, more capital town or even capital village of the island of St. Helena, where Napoleon was exiled. This is a little British possession in the South Atlantic, miles from anywhere, about 1,000 miles west of the coast of Angola. It's the capital, which is called Jamestown, built in the 17th century, a sort of homage to the East India Company. There's a little castle, a little cathedral, a little courthouse, a little jail, a little armory, a little magazine, all perfectly styled and sized and colored with little dolphins and anchors and seahorses. It's just so beautiful. It so speaks of and to the sea that every time I see it, and I've been there 4 or 5 times in my life and every time a memorable time, when finally I disembark from the ship and put on the lighter and bob my way over the harbour through the swells to see this little town, I'm so happy to be there. That seems to be the quintessential Atlantic city. Nothing at all, of course, like the Atlantic City in this country, but a real Atlantic Ocean city. You can see nothing but the sea, and that's one of the wonderful things about it, that there's no land and there are very few ships, because St. Helena now gets maybe one ship calling every 12 weeks, so you're likely to see utter emptiness, just sky and sea, and of course that isolation. They're threatening at the moment, the British government, to build an airfield there, but mercifully the financial straitened circumstances in Britain, I think, are going to delay that. I hope it delays it forever, because the isolation, which of course is one of the reasons why we put Napoleon there in the early part of the 19th century, the isolation is what keeps St. Helena so beautifully preserved, and for my money, long may it remain so.
The ocean itself is destined to live maybe another 200 million years, will humankind still be around to see its coming to an end?
Most certainly not. I mean, this is 170 million years when people think that what will happen is that Cape Horn will move eastwards, will force itself south of South Africa, will go south of Australia, set Australia turning anti-clockwise, and Cape Horn will move north and eventually collide with Singapore. Well, by that time, 170 million years, no, we'll long be history. What will rule the world in those days? Who knows? But one thing is certain, it won't be us.
Well, we are lucky to have seen it in its middle-aged magnificence. And thank you, Simon Winchester, for speaking with us today about the history and character of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2010.